from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, MSNBC Hardball host and author Chris Matthews joins us for the first half hour to discuss the partial shutdown of the government, as well as his most recent book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Work, a memoir of his days working with Democratic Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill and then Republican President Ronald Reagan. Then at 10:30, former Secretary of Labor and UC Berkeley professor Robert Rice joins us to talk about the recently released film Inequality for All, which focuses on economics in the middle class. Join us for this morning's forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Before he became a TV news anchor and commentator, Chris Matthews was a top aide to former House Speaker Tip O'Neill. And in his newest book, Tip and the Gipper, he gives us an inside view of O'Neill's political and personal relationship with Ronald Reagan and how the pair negotiated deals on welfare and military operations despite their differences. We want to discuss the book in this half hour we have with Chris Matthews and find out what insights it offers into the current partial government shutdown. I should mention that he's the author of five other best-selling books, including most recently Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero, and He's a Son Come Home. Some of you may remember he used to be with the San Francisco Examiner. Hadn't seen you in a couple of years now, but we'll be at the World Affairs Council tonight, actually in the Gold Room at the Fairmont Hotel, in discussion at 7 o'clock. And I thought the next time I was going to see you, I'd be calling you Senator Matthews.
Oh, yeah. Well, don't do it.
Well, it's good to have you back here.
Thank you. Thanks, Michael.
And let's begin, actually, by updating and getting your response to this. Obama and Boehner actually spoke this morning. Their summaries of the call are different. I'm looking at the Washington Post, Ezra Klein's reporting of this. He says, late this morning, the president telephoned Speaker Boehner from the Oval Office and repeated what he told him when they met at the White House last week. The president is willing to negotiate. And Speaker Boehner said, the president called the speaker again today to reiterate that he won't negotiate on a government funding bill or debt limit increase. So we've got two different, obviously, interpretations here. But the fact of the matter is, maybe there's some movement here?
Yes, I've been watching yesterday. The words that came out of Boehner's mouth were a conversation. He wanted to have a conversation. That's a lot softer than I want to kill Obamacare. And now the president,
like the president and the president of Iran, a conversation.
And now the president's language here in the report from Ezra, who's a very good guy at explaining economics, Ezra Klein, he talks about something that might help expand economic opportunity, support private sector job creation. That sounds like corporate tax reduction of some kind. So where we thought they were headed, they are headed. Something to do with corporate tax reform of some sort and something to do with entitlement reform, generally speaking. But see, there's so little time to write. You can't write a bill like that, anything to do with corporate tax rates or entitlement reform, in a week and get it approved by both houses and signed. So to meet the 17th deadline, if they do honor it, and I think they absolutely have to honor it, it's going to have to be a side deal, a side letter, an agreement on some goal they're going to set in the near term, maybe a couple of months, to have legislation on the table and signed that deals with these challenges.
You know, this kind of ties in with your book, too, because which, by the way, I found really good reading and fascinating about that. You kept good notes and they served you well. But when you go back to that period, and a lot of people, you're getting a lot of press now because of how polarized things are now and how things have been brinksmanship and ideological rigidity compared to this good relationship that Reagan had with Tip O'Neill. But I kept saying to myself, it was a different zeitgeist. There was no Tea Party. And the reality is they were both Irishmen. They got along and liked each other.
Yeah, I think also they were older. I think something that's very important to this is these guys are in their final act. And they had to get something done. At some point in your life, you stop posturing and positioning and you start doing something because you want something done. And neither one of these guys needed for their career to be seen as posturing as liberal or conservative. They needed to achieve something as liberal or conservative. And I think that's what separates them. The Irish thing helped because they could tell jokes and trade Irish stories and all that sort of blarney. But in the end, Kirk O'Donnell, the chief counsel who I dedicated the book to, along with Mike Deaver, said, you have to always be able to talk. And what they were able to do is get on the phone, and Reagan would say, is it after six? Because they had this after six thing, we're friends. Can you change your watch and make it after six? Tip would say, sure. And then they'd start talking. But it always took intermediaries like Bob Dole or Pat Moynihan or even Danny Rostenkowski, who was clean on the big stuff. ironically, very clean on the big stuff. He got in trouble for his own ethics, but they were able to find solutions. And I look at four or five examples. The easiest fun one was they needed to raise the debt ceiling in early 81 when Reagan first came in. So his head of congressional relations came to see the speaker and said, "We need Democratic votes." And the speaker said, "Fine, all I want is a letter from the president asking for the votes to each of the members so they'd be covered in the next election. Nobody Republican could run against me if Ronald Reagan gave him the stamp of approval." That's how they did things. Or Tip would say with the tax increase of 82, "Just give me a majority of your votes and I'll give you the rest." Or when it came to tax reform, "Give me 50 votes and I'll give you the rest." They were always dealing with numbers and trying to get to a solution. Social Security, Tip said, "I need a progressive solution. What I want to do is find some way of implicitly means testing. So we, for the upper income people who make over $20,000, half their Social Security benefits will be taxed." And the president had to come back and say, "Okay, but at least I need a 3-month delay in the cost of living adjustment." And so that's how they worked it out. It isn't common ground. It's compromise. People get confused about the difference. Common ground means you come to some agreement about what should be done. No. Compromise is when you come to an agreement that if you get this, I'll give you that.
So now we have no compromise.
And no common ground.
And no common
Except,
ground either.
I think
right.
Boehner accepts the common ground fact of October 17th. That's good news.
Well, that is good news. But I was also struck, for example, how the different political parties play different roles here. For example, in your book, you write about, just to be make it local for a moment, Phil Burton drinking and threatening actually fellow Dems if they didn't come around and vote against the budget, there would be all kinds of hell to pay.
It's I was
like
on
the kind of tactics we're talking now, you know, from the Republican
well,
GOP
Phil
side.
Phil was enormously loved by people like George Miller. They looked up to him like you can't believe. But he was notoriously as a drinker and being foul-mouthed. And I watched him in action. I compared him to Harpo Marx in Hell. This strange-looking guy, big, tall guy, menacing, going around the floor, intimidating people, like trying to intimidate Henry Waxman, who was about half his height. And Henry just stood up to him and said, "I'm not budging. I'm voting with the party on this. I'm voting with the budget." And he was going around to the Black Caucus members, anybody else on the left, saying, "Bring this down." And I went to see the speaker. I said, "You got to stop. You got to stop Burton." He said, "What am I going to do? He's drunk." This is real-life politics.
But this kind of real-life politics that you're talking about, I mean, how does Ted Cruz and 19 similar-feeling Tea Partyites, you call them jackals, I think, at one point.
No, they are. the far right is. I'm not talking about conservative.
No, but how do they get 200 to go along with them?
I don't. That is the great mystery because, first of all, apparently, according to Hastert, there is no Hastert rule. There's no requirement of a majority of the Republicans to vote to bring something to the floor. And even if you followed that rule that Boehner seems to be accepting, which is he needs half the Republicans, they've got 230. All they have to do is get 200 without the 30. But, you know, they don't want to ask for any Democratic votes. Now, that's really peculiar. I mean, it's one thing to go with the Hastert rule. But if they say we don't want to pass anything if it requires Democratic votes, what kind of a House of Representatives is it?
Talking with Chris Matthews, and he has a book, a new book, I'll call Tip and the Gipper, all about the years he served for Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, and actually saw some real politics and real, not necessarily common ground, but compromise work being done between the Speaker of the House and then President Ronald Reagan. Let me open up the phone lines here early on because this is only a half-hour segment and we'd like to hear from you if you want to jump in here and have some memories of that particular period. I also want to find out if Chris Matthews, as he said on Colbert, would really like to see Bill O'Reilly killed.
No, that's what I said was I want his next book to be Killing O'Reilly. Even he knew that was a joke.
But you took it along okay? Could you work for compromise with Bill O'Reilly?
He took it okay, and I think I've got to read this book, Killing Jesus, because I was imagining satirically that his next book would be Killing Jesus, but the guy has such an ego that he said, "I'm hearing from the Holy Spirit." He thinks he's a prophet. It takes an ego to say that.
Well, actually,
I mean, who is this guy?
This
Abraham?
Is not a segue from egos, but Bob Reich is our guest at 9:30, and I think Bill O'Reilly called him a communist. I mean, this is sort of McCarthy tactics. People are comparing Cruz to some extent in terms of his style.
Well,
McCarthy.
Well, let me tell you, I did it because I tell you what he did was when Chuck Hagel, who's a moderate Republican, was up for defense. He, in the hearings, on the record, he said, "How do we know that 200,000 didn't come from the North Koreans?" And I confronted him in the green room last week to meet the press, and I said, "That's McCarthy stuff. You can't do that."
What do you say to that?
"I don't like the way you talk about me." And I said, "Well, you talk like McCarthy. You can't talk like he." I think he lacks any political history in his mind. He may be well educated in a formal sense, but Do you remember Advise and Consent, the great film, sure, and the great book? Remember Ackerman? He was sort of a left-wing version of McCarthy. George Gazzard played him. He got shunned by the Senate at the end because he had obviously outed this poor member of Congress who had the gay affair in the service. And it's a heck of a movie, a much better book even. And that's who he's playing. He's playing Ackerman. Now, we'll see if he gets truly shunned. I think he will be for a while. I think he's a Roman candle politically. He'll be very hot for a couple of years, but you can't sustain this level of heat in politics the way he's playing it.
No chance of his perhaps nabbing the GOP if he gets enough independents, libertarians, and Tea Partyites.
I'm with Charlie Cook. Rather, he's with me now. For months now, I've been saying it's going to be Rand Paul. The party is going to lurch to the right, but not that far.
And is this going to be a one party? They're moving toward that like they have in California.
This is perfect for Hillary Clinton. She's a centrist. She's to the right of me on foreign policy. I think she's a bit more hawkish than Obama. I think she, on domestic issues, she's in the sweet spot of Hubert Humphrey and classic Democrats like her husband. I think if she's healthy and she's got the excitement about doing it, the bug again, she's going to do very well against Rand Paul.
We're going to hear Benghazi and Benghazi and Benghazi.
Benghazi. And by the way, before, during, and after, the only question that is a hot one, I believe, is during. Just explain what steps were taken when you heard that facility in Benghazi was under fire and it's over with. It is a relevant question, and it hasn't been answered thoroughly. But the other stuff is bureaucratic questioning. How come you didn't have enough defense there? When, in fact, it was Chris Stevens' decision to go there. He knew how dangerous it was. He had to make the call on the ground. And as for what was done later in explaining it, whether it was a terrorist attack or it was, in fact, something that escalated, as Hillary rightly said, who cares? But what people do care about, was our government on guard at the moment, and did we do everything we could to get our troops there, or our air forces there from Italy or wherever the hell they had to come from? And that's my question, because you can't just say it would have taken 2 or 3 hours to get there, because the fighting could still be going on in 2 or 3 hours. These are just questions that I think are legitimate.
Well, one more question before, and I haven't even given out the phone number yet. If you want to join us with Chris Matthews, it's toll-free 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement in the program, so join the conversation with any questions or comments you might have. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or post any questions or comments you have immediately onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. One of the reasons, I suppose, there's a lot of nostalgia about maybe the era when you were working with Tip O'Neill and observing this after-six relationship that was somewhat personal between Reagan and the real fondness that Reagan and O'Neill had for each other. One of the reasons that I often hear when I talk to politicians is you can't really be in Washington and have the personal and the political collide the way. In fact, not only are things so polarized that people don't even say hello to each other in the elevator,
it's
and
terrible,
all that sort of thing. I mean, it's ugly. The enmity is ugly. But aside from that, people aren't living in Washington or around Washington the way they used to do and socializing the way they used to do it.
Newt Gingrich has a lot to do with this. When he came in as a sort of a revolutionary speaker, with a lot of hostility around him and from him towards the way things have been going, he told all the freshmen who got elected in 94 to leave their spouses at home out in the country so they wouldn't come to Washington. He said, leave your press secretary at home. In other words, position yourself to get reelected, but not to join Washington. And Tip, ever since he was a young guy, would always meet the freshman class and say, as soon as you can afford it, bring your wife here. It was usually wife in those cases. Bring her here because this is going to keep your marriage together. You'll spend 5 days together. You'll go campaign for Saturday and come back and meet with your wife. You'll be with her most of the time. And that's better for marriages. It's better for social life. So Newt really wanted to break up that system of Bob Michael being friends with Tip and playing golf with him on weekends. And he wanted to break up any kind of social life between the two parties.
But now he's converted to Catholicism. Maybe he'll do a shift.
Well, he was – just remember, he was having an affair at the same time he was leading the impeachment against Clinton. That takes a certain kind of duality of mind. Who was it that said it's hard to keep two conflicting ideas in your head at the same time? Maybe Fitzgerald. But he was able to keep two. The girlfriend, and we got to get Clinton for what he did. It's not funny because it's hypocrisy of the kind that really just – to the worst impulses in this country to say, I don't care about politics. I just give up on it. That's a bad impulse. And I think Newt encourages that.
Get our callers on. Paul, you're our first caller. Good morning.
Hey, Chris. Paul, an old friend of yours from the White House. Hey, I'm curious about following up on the whole Rand Paul phenomenon. How do you see that playing out in the Republican Party? If you think he's going to be the nominee, does that isolate them more? How do you see it playing out from Iowa throughout the primaries?
Well, Mr. Costello, it's nice to hear from you. First of all, I think Rand Paul is a joiner. He's not, he may be a rebel intellectually, but he's socially willing to join the Republican caucus. He's getting along very well with Mitch McConnell. He's playing the game, if you will. I also think he doesn't scare people. He appeals very much to the young libertarian in the party. He's anti-war. If he told you what he really thought, which he won't, he really did question the Civil Rights Act of 64. So he's a real Goldwater guy. And I think that, as was the case with Goldwater, if it wasn't for the nuclear button at the time, he would have done much better. But the ferocity of our concern about what Goldwater could do, you know, saying he wanted to have field commanders the right to use nuclear weapons in the field at their own volition, those kind of statements just scared the heck out of everyone. But I'm not sure Rand Paul scares people the way that sort of intent-looking, let's put it that way, Ted Cruz comes off as humorless, God-driven, whereas Rand Paul is much more secular. I don't know what his religion is, but he seems very secular in his politics. And as I said, not very threatening.
Is he like his old man in terms of foreign policy? Like, why should we care about Iran and all that? So yeah. He is pretty much chip off the old
block. Not to knock him, because I think my politics are close to him in this regard, but I think he believes that, like Pat Buchanan, a total nationalist. But it doesn't have to be as brutal as that, because after all these wars, I think that's an easier sell than when Pat Buchanan was selling it. Just we've had it with these unending wars. And I think that's why we didn't want to go into Syria. The country didn't.
A listener writes on our website, I hope Mr. Matthews can comment on how O'Neill and Reagan together started the modern era of massive federal deficits. Not all cooperation is useful. And by the way, we ought to add, the government shut down a number of times under Tip O'Neill's speakership.
Yeah, it did. And they were brief and they were forgettable. I got to tell you, they lasted hours, at the most 2 days.
But the listener's right, the massive deficits.
Yeah, but those things were growing. And I tell you, what happened was, and by the way, under O'Neill, just if you want to get hostile, buddy, here's what's going on here. In 82... they raised the largest tax increase in history because O'Neill pushed it to Reagan, and Reagan accepted it. So he was doing what he could to offset the voodoo economics of 81. And Reagan, a lot of it, I don't think they started it, by the way. I think W was the one that really sort of instigated it by saying, I'm not signing any veto bills. I'm not vetoing any appropriations bill. Anything goes here. That was really when the attitude grew.
Bring in another caller, and we go next to Calistoga. Frederick, morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. It was a tough call whether to call you, Chris, or to wait for Mr. Reich. I'm happy to hear you. Let's remember that Bill Clinton left the Treasury with a surplus, so that we have seen a positive government role in this society. And I wanted to ask you, Mr. Matthews, why would we be surprised that we have ended up at this point with conservatives since Goldwater denigrating the public sector and wanting to close down government?
Well, first of all, we had a very good economy in the 1990s, and Bill Clinton didn't do anything to hurt that. He was very successful allowing the government to go into surplus. Of course, we still had the national debt, which was enormous, but he did a really good job in terms of NAFTA. He was seen as pro-business, I think, in that regard. I think that was very powerful for a Democrat to make that decision to go with NAFTA, the trade bill that Bush Sr. had advocated. I think the no vote is the safest vote in the Republican Party today. When you have 230 seats that are basically anti-Obama seats who voted for Romney, you have a combination of gerrymandering and segregated housing in this country, segregated neighborhoods where all the big cities have most of the minorities and liberals by self-decision. You basically have areas like the Bay Area we're in right now, where 85% of the people vote for Pelosi, 85% for Barbara Lee. You go to my hometown of Philadelphia, 85% for Obama. And what happens is you flood the zone. And therefore, these Republicans are very safe in their districts. They can't really be defeated. So all they have to do is guard the outside rail and make sure they are the most conservative person who could possibly run in the next primary. And their only real boss is the loudmouth in the next town meeting they go to, in the back row usually, who yells out, you sold us out. You're one of them. And they seem very afraid of that. You're one of them. And so they always stay very close to the rail of the most right-wing position they can take, and it guards them against a primary challenge. And you could argue, if you wanted to, for extension, that in liberal districts or in African-American districts, the only threat an African-American member or liberal member faces is somebody younger than them to their left. And so they're pretty predictable, too.
This is Frank from San Rafael. Says, comparing then and now, what role has the impact of the technological changes and methods of communication had on the political process? It's pretty quantum, isn't it, Chris?
Yeah, I think it's... It's the ability to wire yourself to your beliefs exclusively, that you can actually cocoon with your thoughts and find that they're confirmed every hour.
But you don't have to meet beyond 6 p.m. either, because everybody's coming over cable where you are.
You don't have to. And when people tell me they watch MSNBC all day, I feel like saying, well, okay, that's during the day. It's not that ideological, but you ought to mix it up. Stop and take an hour off and read a newspaper and read the journal. I'm not talking about the editorial page. I'm talking about the newspaper. Read it on Saturday. The review section is excellent. The cultural stuff. Read Peggy Noonan. Read other people. You'll hear another point of view that won't offend you. It'll just sort of enrich you in a way by sort of sharpening your own views or maybe broadening them. But I always tell people there's no Walter Cronkite around. He says that's the way it is. And even he admitted he was an establishment liberal. I wasn't as surprised as anybody else. You're going to get a point of view. So that to be intelligent, you should mix it up a bit. That's what I think.
And here's Will, who writes, Chris, Newt wasn't impeaching Clinton for cheating. He was impeaching Clinton for lying, which is exactly why he was disbarred.
Fine. If that's what you believe, fine. If anybody thinks it wasn't about Monica, fine. It was about Monica.
Talk about what people believe. Here's Brian.
And by the way, why did they go after him in the discovery? Why did they get him under oath? Why did they bring in the Paula Jones case, extending that into Monica? What was all that about? Was that a crusade? Yes.
Is Brian who wrote crusade? I thought after Bush we weren't supposed to use that word.
I went to Holy Cross with the Crusaders. Not as bad as the Redskins, but the Crusaders.
Redskins going to go, I think.
Do you think? Do you think Dan Snyder will do that?
Maybe not this year, but the pressure is really on him. I mean, when the President of the United States says he ought to reconsider, and if I were the owner of the Redskins, I would really reconsider. It seems to be really moving in that direction. But let me read you another email here, talk about what people believe. Brian writes, Hillary doesn't have a chance. She's too old on the political scene, and we already know all about her, and she hasn't really ever accomplished anything.
Well, fine. That's a judgment that's not shared. Let me tell you about what she has going for besides her credentials. Every woman my age I meet has a point of view on this. It's time. The men have had their run. They want a woman to have a shot. It's powerful. It's gender, and it's powerful. And
the numbers are there.
And I think the women are the predominant voter in the country. And in the Democratic primaries, I can't see her losing. She made big tactical mistakes up with Mark Penn and the rest of them. They ignored all the caucus states. They ignored states they couldn't win in the general. They weren't paying attention to South Dakota and places like that. They were putting all their focus on the big states. And along came this guy, Barack Obama, who was the new kid on the block. And he said, wait a minute, if we accumulate enough delegates from all these states that don't matter, we can beat the people who win the states that do matter. And that was smart calculation.
Speaking about along came Barack Obama, is the right ever going to let up on you talking about your thigh and Barack Obama?
No, it wasn't. Don't get too close there. It wasn't the thigh. It was the leg.
The leg. Okay. Sorry.
No, I don't care. It's fine. I was physically thrilled in those speeches when Obama talked about my country. And if anybody wants to go back and watch, it was the night of the Potomac primary. When this African-American guy from a fascinating background with the name Barack Hussein Obama gets elected president and begins to speak, I should say, back in 2004 when I said right after he spoke at the convention, you've just heard from the first African-American president. They don't want to give me the credit for knowing what I'm doing. He thrilled me. And by the way, Reagan, I've been reading Reagan's diaries, the physical thrill he would get. He would talk about his spine tingling. He would talk about a throw up his back. Anybody doesn't love this country enough to be physically affected by good talk about the country. It doesn't know me and doesn't connect with the country. You mean you're physically immune to talk about our country? Physically immune to it? Who are these people?
I get chills when I hear the Star Spangled Banner to this day.
Well, I think so.
We got seconds left.
By the way, if you don't, I wonder about you.
We'll wonder about each other, but I have seconds left. Koch brothers and those people behind all this, they planned all this?
Have you noticed that all the amendments they want to attach to the debt ceiling have to do with exploration in the Gulf, exploration of oil and gas on federal lands? Who's writing these bills? Come on, the Koch brothers.